The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. We're here for oral argument in Johnson v. Shulkin, number 162891. At the request of appellant, could counsel please state their appearances for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. Jason Fowler from Covington and Burling on behalf of appellant Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Fowler.
Laura Jemison and co-counsel Ed Cassidy on behalf of the secretary.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jemison. Mr. Fowler, I understand that you've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
And I think John's got that. All right.
For the record, I'd like to note co-counsel is Mr. Patrick Berkshire from the National Veterans Legal Services Program.
Nice to see you again. Anytime you're ready, Mr. Fowler.
Good morning. Judge Allen, may it please the court. The May 2009 medical report clearly establishes Mr. Johnson's entitlement to a level 3 disability for traumatic brain injury. That report parrots the language of
Diagnostic Code 8045 and says exactly what Diagnostic Code 8045 requires for a level 3 disability rating, that Mr. Johnson has objective evidence on testing of moderate impairment of memory, attention, concentration, and executive function with moderate functional impairment. And the board's decision acknowledges that the May 2009 medical report says just that. The board, however, failed to give the May 2009 medical report sufficient probative weight in light of what it perceived as an inconsistency. And the only inconsistency that the board notes is that there are references to mild memory impairment. And apparently, in the board's view, mild memory impairment is inconsistent with moderate impairment of memory, concentration, attention, and executive function. I think the secretary here does not dispute that those two things in and of themselves are not inconsistent. In other words, someone can have mild memory impairment and can have something more than mild impairment of attention, concentration, or executive function and still be entitled to the level 3 disability rating.
So what do we do with the fact that the board is the entity that makes that call? In other words, that the adequacy of a medical exam is one that's a question of fact. And I should say, this is not the situation in which this normally arises. It's not usually the board discounting a VA medical examination for that, but it's still a question of fact.
Yeah, you're right, Your Honor, it is. And in fact, the board here expressly found that the May 2009 medical report was complete, thorough, and contained sufficient bases to make a determination with respect to his disability rating. That's at record page 8. It later determined that in when compared, I guess, to the later medical reports, that this apparent inconsistency in the report somehow, I guess, made the other two preponderate against Mr. Johnson's claim for an increased rating. But when that inconsistency is corrected, and it's something that this court is entitled to do under the statute, to set aside or to reverse a clearly erroneous fact-finding, the report stands, as the board found, to be complete, thorough, and contains sufficient bases for the board to make a ratings determination.
So what if, let's just assume for a second that I agree with all of that, that the board's statement that the report is good and solid then seems to turn around at the end of the story, and these references to mild and moderate are at least confusing about how this is. At that point, you ask for reversal. So first of all, explain to me exactly how you see that operating. So assume that you are what is for you an assumption, but what is for me a reality, which is I'm going to leave the room, I'm going to have to go write an opinion, or decide to send it to a panel. But what would that opinion say if I wanted to reverse?
I think it would say a few things. It would say, at least with respect to the time period following the May 2009 medical report and leading up to the January 2013 medical report, that the only evidence in the record requires Mr. Johnson to have a level 3 disability rating. There's certainly nothing contrary to the May 2009 medical report in the record until you get to the January 2013 medical report. So at least with respect to that time period, it's a straight-up reversal. Looking at the period that follows January 2013, when the additional medical report from Dr. Coulson was prepared, I think you do have the ability to reverse on the basis that the board's conclusion that the evidence preponderated against the claim is clearly erroneous. This court in Mariano and later in Padgett said that the court's obligation to take account of the benefit of the doubt rule when determining whether the board's determinations should rise or fall necessarily requires at least reference to probativeness of the evidence. And here we have all of the fact findings have been made by the board. Once the inconsistency finding is reversed, you have at least a balance of evidence.
So that's the point I want to explore with you. I agree, it gets a little bit metaphysical here. But so on the one hand, we're told that we can reverse even when there's controverted evidence. Right? That's now established. But on the other hand, we can't find facts in the first instance. But on the third hand, if you will, we have to make sure that the secretary complies with the benefit of the doubt rule. Right? So let's just assume that we say that the 2009 report should have been considered for what it was, its conclusion, the moderate. We have at least two other medical reports. How do we draw the line between inappropriate fact-finding to say the 2009 report is better than the other two and taking into due account the rule that we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the veteran? How does that work?
I agree that it requires some line drawing. I think the message from the Federal Circuit in DeLoach and from Congress in 7261 and from the precedent of this court at least requires the court to take a look at whether or not the board's finding that the evidence preponderates against the claim would be a clearly erroneous application of the benefit of the doubt rule. You see that in Mariano, where the board had merely determined that the evidence preponderated against the evidence, and Mariano, in at least three occasions, finds that to be clearly erroneous and reverses it on the basis that it would be an improper application of the benefit of the doubt rule. And so, while I acknowledge that there is going to be some line drawing, I think that's what this court is going to be required to do under 7261, under DeLoach, and under Mariano, Padgett, and some of the later cases that have found, even where controverting evidence was in the record, that reversal was nevertheless appropriate.
So in this case, right, the board never had to do this balancing of 2009 versus 13 and 15 or whatever the dates were, right? I mean, I'm right about that, right? The board never balanced them because it got rid of the 2009 one. Is that right?
You're correct that they didn't engage in any explicit balancing. I'm not entirely certain that they got rid of the May 2009 medical report so much as they said when it came time to determine whether there was evidence in the record supporting an increased disability rating that it was inconsistent, and for that reason the subsequent medical reports would govern.
So, well, because here's what I'm wrestling with. I've sort of got two questions, but I won't get to the second one yet. But so in the order granting oral argument, I asked the parties to think about Byron versus Shinseki. Because what's interesting about Byron is there's a line in Byron that suggests that the board must make a factual determination first. In other words, it's a little bit different than DeLoach, right? Because DeLoach is talking about reversing a determination that has been made by the board. What's your take on Byron and its line about the board has to make a call first before we can even be in a position to reverse, if you follow that.
I do, and I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about Byron. But my read of Byron in its reference, its repeated reference to what it calls initial factual determinations or initial fact findings, is it reads to me more like it is the board, not the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, that should have made these factual determinations with respect to what would look like prima facie elements, right? So in Byron, Ms. Byron was trying to establish a direct service connection, not relying on the presumption under the statute and regulations. And the Federal Circuit said, look, we can't be the ones here that have to make these initial two determinations, one being whether Mr. Byron was even exposed to radiation in the first place, and second, whether the radiation actually caused his disability. And those would have been prima facie elements of Ms. Byron's case. Both the VA and Ms. Byron agreed that those had not been made, and it seemed the Federal Circuit's ruling, I think, was a straightforward application that courts of appeals can't make those kinds of calls in the first instance. Here, I think the board has made the initial factual determinations that are required, and this court can assess those under the applicable standards of review.
So what I was puzzled about here is, because you had made a point earlier about whether the board got rid of the 2009 opinion totally or didn't, and I agree the board's decision is not, well, it's not clear to me about that. I was perplexed by the fact that everything in that report, the purported inconsistency, was a level 2 and a level 3, if I'm reading this right under the TBI residuals. What's your understanding of how the board got to level 1? Right, because if that opinion is still there and there's an inconsistency, that sort of baffled me.
One could, in a sense, look at what the board did as an implied balancing or an implied benefit of the doubt rule, in the sense that once the May 2009 medical report was deemed by the board to be inconsistent, that in its view, the weight of the other two overwhelmed, such that as the board expressly found, that the evidence preponderated against the claim for an increased rating. And so in that sense, I don't view it as inconsistent. Let me start over. I don't think that the board's finding of a level one rating necessarily means that it threw out the May 2009 medical report so much as some sort of an implied determination that it was insufficient to overcome what it concluded to be two medical reports that found level one. And I think there are reasons why it's probably inappropriate to consider there to be two additional as opposed to being one. Dr. Colson in the second report effectively just parroted his prior determination. It's interesting because I went back and I looked at the remand opinion that requested the May 2015 medical report, and it provided that based on testimony at the hearing that the board found probative and competent, that Mr. Johnson's symptoms were increasing in severity, that a new medical examination should be conducted, and that the results of that medical examination should be, I think, analyzed in detail. The record cites there are 617 to 18 and 621 to 22. But the bottom line being that the board, in light of Mr. Johnson and his girlfriend's testimony at the hearing, requested that a new examination take place. As you can see from the record, it's an extremely conclusory examination, same doctor relying on the same evidence, reaching the same conclusions, and at the end it effectively says nothing's changed. But he didn't do additional objective testing, which strikes me as contrary to what the board requested when it remanded for an additional medical opinion.
So just some of the colloquy we've been having, I mean, on something as basic as what did the fact finder do with the May 2009 exam? I mean, it's not clear to me. Doesn't that suggest that this really is a reasons and basis question? In other words, if I've got to make a call about whether the board was clearly erroneous on something, I sort of have to know what the board did before I can decide whether what it did was clearly erroneous, right?
I would agree that that is generally going to be the case, but not always. I mean, the standard is if the court is left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made, then it's appropriate to reverse. One could imagine all of the various explanations for what the board or for why the board did what it did, and any number of those, maybe all of them, could result in your determination that the finding, which is what's at issue, is clearly erroneous. And so I would submit that in this case, any explanation of what the board did could be found to in your mind, if you're so inclined, to be a mistake rising to the level of reversing the initial determination.
Well, I mean, so hypothetically, what if what the board did was simply discount the probative value of the report because it did not sufficiently explain how it got to moderate, given that one of its inputs was mild, only on one of four of the facet features? That would be very different than if the board actually got rid of the entire opinion because of that. So, I mean, imagine that I'm a replay official in football, right? And I need to decide whether what the referee did on the field is right. Wouldn't I have to know the call the referee made before I could engage in a process of reviewing what that is?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think here we know what the board did because it's contained in the board's opinion. It concluded the only basis, and remember, this is after the board found that the decision, the medical report, was complete, thorough, and sufficient, contained sufficient bases to make a determination. It reduced the value, at least that's how I read it, it reduced the value of the medical report based on one and only one perceived inconsistency. That's what the board did, and there's no reason to believe the board did anything else. It concluded that references to mild memory impairment were somehow inconsistent with moderate impairment of memory, attention, concentration, executive function. I think it was a straight-up misreading of the diagnostic code. Maybe it's because the diagnostic code was fairly new to the board and hadn't had occasion to pass on it before. But insofar as that is the reason that the board did what it did, and I think the board is clear that that is why it did what it did, then that's a question that you can clearly pass on in this instance and say the board misinterpreted the regulation. There is sufficient basis in the medical report to support the examiner's finding of a level 3 disability, such that the decision in and of itself to reduce the value of the May 2009 medical report is reversed. I don't think you need to send it back to ask the board anything else, at least on that front.
Well, so, I mean, one could agree with you on that point and still end up with the quandary of what to do next, right? You could say you were wrong about whatever you did with the 2009 report, clearly wrong. And then that just puts it back into the mix. And really, that's the thing we have to consider if we take everything you've said up to this point, right, about whether that is making an initial call or enforcing the benefit of the doubt standard.
Yes, Your Honor. And I mean, there are variations on what you could do in this case. Obviously, it could be a complete reversal and an instruction to the board and the VA to give Mr. Johnson the level 3 disability rating. It could also be a reversal, at least for the period that leads from May 2009 to January 2013. It could be a reversal of the finding that the May 2009 medical report is entitled to less weight because of an alleged or perceived inconsistency. Any of those things, particularly the first one, would narrow what happens on remand, would streamline the proceedings, and at least would promote judicial efficiency.
So, and I know your time is coming, but I've got two final questions for that. One is, you had not made this argument. I'm not criticizing you for that. It's just I hadn't thought about it before you said it, that there should be something like a staged rating here? Are you saying that from the May 2009 report up to the next report? That's not usually the way we think about that, right? Because I think the reports were considering the same question. The follow-up report was just to provide a new report. So well, I'm wondering.
There's no evidence. There's certainly nothing in the subsequent two medical reports themselves suggesting that this was a retrospective look at Mr. Johnson's disability rating. I think on their face they appear pretty plainly to be, what is Mr. Johnson's condition now? In fact, the only thing I would say is that this final one in May 2015 is just a do-over in some sense of the January 2013 one. It just says nothing's changed. He didn't bother to do an additional objective examination of Mr. Johnson as was requested by the board. And one thing I would just note quickly before my time ends is that the diagnostic code itself said that these symptoms vary day to day. And so in some sense, just because Mr. Johnson did a little better in January 2013 or May 2015, if you're inclined to credit those opinions, it doesn't mean that those are inconsistent with what happened in May 2009, because as the diagnostic code itself recognizes, the symptoms inherently change from day to day. I see my time is up.
And before you sit down, I have one more question for you, which is, assuming we were to remand, okay, you make a request that the remand should be limited to whether Mr. Johnson is entitled to a level 2 or level 3 disability rating. In other words, you're asking for a very targeted, very targeted remand. Could you just talk me through that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the primary argument is simply one that the Secretary failed to respond to the argument. It was crystal clear that was our position in the opening brief. It was one of the issues to be decided in the statement of the issues. It was also a section heading under well-established precedent. I mean, from the Supreme Court and down, they're supposed to respond to arguments that are in the opening brief, or they can be deemed waived. I know that this court has employed what appears to be more like a discretionary rule, that in some circumstances the court can determine that the Secretary's failure to respond to arguments in the opening brief is a concession that those arguments are correct, or that the Secretary concedes to that course of action following the decision, and that's principally our argument here. They didn't respond, and it's probably inappropriate for them to respond now for the first time, but that, of course, is within Your Honor's sound discretion.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Farr. We'll see you
thank
for
you.
Rebuttal. Ms. Jensen.
Good morning again, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The Board's June 3, 2016 decision should be affirmed because the Board's determinations are not clearly erroneous and appellant has not met his burden to demonstrate prejudicial error. The standard of review in this particular instance of the Board's factual determination of a proper evaluation of a disability is performed under the clearly erroneous standard of review, which under this standard says that if there is a plausible basis in the record for the factual determinations of the Board, the Court cannot overturn them even if it would not have reached the same factual determinations. In this particular instance, that's exactly what appellant is asking you to do. Here, the Board...
What is your understanding of... and this isn't a trick question. I mean, it's a question for which I do not have a clear answer. What did the Board do with the May 2009 exam?
Well, Judge Allen, it is the Secretary's position that the Board actually looked at that exam and in assigning it less probative value, it declined to interpret what the medical examiner meant by those findings.
So let me end. This may come across sounding unfair, and I don't mean it to, okay? Imagine that the world were reversed and that all along the way in the report, and I'm not saying this report is like this, but just for my hypothetical, the person, the doctor, is saying moderate, right? So, I mean, in this report, we've got the one way to look at it. We have the text of the report that uses mild, and then all of a sudden we get moderate in the conclusion. Right? I know Mr. Fowler is going to say something on rebuttal about that. I'm just setting that up as a hypothetical, okay? What if it were reversed, and all along in the body of the report, moderate, and then all of a sudden, for some reason, the conclusion comes out mild? Do you think the board would have done the same thing?
I mean, obviously, it's an opinion that you're asking for here. I would say, based on the evidence in this case and the facts in this case, my answer would be yes, because what they did was they declined to step into the shoes of the examiner to figure out what he meant.
Why wouldn't it have been appropriate for the board to say, hey, Mr. Examiner, what did you mean?
I agree with you, Judge Allen. The board could have and maybe should have done that to get additional information from the examiner to clarify. However, in this particular instance, they didn't. So now we're left with an examination that has some confusion with it. Obviously, the remedy for that would generally be to either have a new examination, which in this particular instance, there are two subsequent examinations, so that remedy has been exercised. Otherwise, there could be the instance of sending it back for clarification. However, we would submit that at this point in time, that exam was performed in 2009, and the TBI rating criteria is based on objective testing. So it would be a little bit difficult to try to determine exactly what the results of those objective tests in 2009 would be and to reconcile them.
So what about, how would you respond to Mr. Feller, the appellant's argument that essentially the board here just got it wrong in a clear way because it fastened on one aspect of facet number one, right, which has four components, and it fastened on this idea of mild with respect to one, and therefore was clearly wrong because of the other things in the exam that would have gone to the other parts of that cognitive facet?
Where the Secretary disagrees with appellant's analysis of the examination is that the board did not make an actual, again, did not step into the examiner's shoes and wholesale pick one or the other. What they simply did was look at it on its face and say, we can't determine what you meant here.
So what did the board mean at the, I didn't mean to cut you off, but what did the board mean then at the beginning of its decision? Where it said, this exam is great, right? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously. I don't have the language in front of me. But it seemed to say, all good. We complied with our duty to assist. And then by the end, it's almost like a mystery story. You turn the last page of the board opinion and you say, oh, my God, the butler did it. I didn't see it coming, right? So what was the board's thinking at the beginning?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I can't answer that for you. I do agree that, you know, being that they did find that the examination was adequate on the one instance, but then they actually didn't turn around and determine it was inadequate. They just determined it was inconsistent.
So, that's where I'm really going, mm-hmm. right? I'm really going to, you know, what are we actually talking about here, right? Because I know you're doing a great job representing your client. You started off by saying you want me to affirm, right? That wasn't a Butler did it moment. I figured that's what you're going to say. But doesn't this really, though, come down to the fact that how could I possibly affirm this when the board says, let's just take the simple thing. This exam is great. It is adequate. Boy, is this exam awful from beginning to end, right? So doesn't that put me in the position of my choice is really whether I'm going to reverse something or remand? I mean, isn't that really where we are?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree. And the reason that I would disagree is because, as I stated before, in this particular instance, again, while I do understand appellant's argument, in order to actually make an interpretation, either for the board to make an interpretation or for the court to make an interpretation of the 2009 examination, it would require either entity to stand in the shoes of the examiner. And based on this court's own precedential decision in Colvin, it can't do that. While I stated before in response to your question, yes, there was an opportunity and maybe should have been an opportunity for the board to get clarification as to trying to determine exactly what the examiner meant. Respectfully, Your Honor, we would submit that that ship has sailed and there isn't really a way to reconcile the findings in that examination. However, the fact that there have been subsequent examinations cures the defect of the potential defect, as this court may see it, in the board's decision as far as whether or not the examination was inadequate but then found to be subsequently inconsistent. excuse me. Additionally, the case law requires that the board can't rely on a medical examiner's conclusory statements if they're lacking supporting analysis. And it appears that that's exactly what the board had an issue with in this particular case.
So let me ask you, let's just assume, let's leave the facts of this case to the side for a second. I want to go up on 10,000-foot level for a second. So let's just assume with me, that the question we have is a binary question. So there are only two answers, either zero or one. Right? And we have now exhausted my knowledge of mathematics, so don't worry, we're not going to go down that road. Right? But there are two answers, zero and one. The board makes a factual finding that the answer is one. The court concludes that that factual finding is clearly erroneous. In the Secretary's position, could the court say appropriately that the answer is zero? All right, so there are two options, right? It's like flipping a coin, right? Either zero or one. The board says zero, or one in my hypothetical. The court determines that's clearly erroneous. Wouldn't at that point the only answer be zero?
I would imagine under the facts that you just gave, yes. However, I disagree with the idea that that can be applied in this particular instance.
Oh, yeah, we're not getting there yet, right? So I wanted that's what I mean. I want to make this as sort of pristine as possible, okay. Right? Now, I confess to you, right, that on the hypothetical that I just gave you, the 0-1, right, I think the answer is right. The court could say 0. It wouldn't have to in every situation because if, in fact, let's say the board made a determination that the answer was 1 and there was no evidence on the topic before the board, right? They just went off on a detour and frolic, right? Well, then the court probably couldn't say zero because the reason it's clearly erroneous is there's no support one way or the other, right? So there'd have to be evidence on the topic. But in that situation, I tell you my bias, I think the court can say zero because if you exclude one, there's only one option left as long as there's some evidence, okay? Now, stay with me on the next question, okay? Let's assume we're in a world of instead of being binary, we're going to call it trinary. I have no idea if that's a word, but meaning that there are three possible options to the answer to the question, okay? 2, 1, and 0. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, assume the board says the answer is 1, okay? Comes to the court concludes, there's evidence on the topic, okay? The court concludes that that finding is clearly erroneous, so one is off the table, leaving two potential options, 0 and 2. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the evidence is conflicting between those two, we have to send it back to the board because the board has to make a factual call. I'm assuming you'll agree with that.
Yes.
Okay. But let me change this up. Assume that we've gotten answer number one off the table. That's clearly erroneous. There's evidence on the topic. There are now two possible options. But what we do is we look at this and we say, listen, on this evidence, if the board had said two, that would have been clearly erroneous as well. Wouldn't that then leave only option zero, meaning the court could actually do it in a situation where it wasn't a coin flip, if the evidence were right?
Well, there's a couple of issues with the hypothetical. I mean, I guess hypothetically, yes. However, in real life, in as confined by the law that's before us right now, the court wouldn't be able to do that.
Let me just stop you for 1 second on that, mm-hmm. because I want to know whether you're saying that there's a legal problem, meaning that there is some law that says the court couldn't do that, or are you saying theoretically it's possible, but so sort of like it's theoretically possible that I could dunk a basketball. It's never going to happen, right? So it's possible. There's not a rule against it, but it's never going to happen, right? So your answer sort of mixed those two things. One is there is a legal rule that prevents that from happening on the one hand, or there's no legal rule that could happen, but the facts would never realistically be such that that could happen.
It's more so that there is statutory prohibition against the court acting as the fact finder.
And you're talking about whatever 7261, one of the subsections, I'm assuming, right?
Yes. But on the other hand, I mean, it's a tenuous thing because on the other hand, the court is allowed to be the fact finder when there's determinations as far as prejudicial error. So my answer kind of encompasses both because in this, if we are, for instance, applying the facts of this case, it doesn't fall neatly into a clean hypothetical. I could see where the hypothetical that you just gave might be something where if we were just talking about, for instance, a simple range of motion disagreement where the board said that it was 60 and the court said, no, it's 80, then it's very cut and dry. Whereas in this particular fact pattern, there's a whole lot of evidence at play here, and it would not fit quite so succinctly and neatly into a yes or no hypothetical.
So I assume that the Secretary is on board with the concept that at least in theory, the court could reverse in a situation in which we are talking about whether the benefit of the doubt standard was appropriately applied?
If the court were to find that the board's finding was clearly erroneous, yes.
Okay.
However, again, in this particular fact pattern here, of this case, we disagree because in order for the court to even make that step, it would have to find that the board's findings were not plausibly based on the record that it had before it. And in this instance, appellant's argument kind of is predicated on his own weighing of the evidence. And that's not his job, that's not the court's job, that's not the secretary's job. That's the exclusive job of the board. And the board has done their job here. They actually looked at all three examinations, the VA treatment records, as well as the lay evidence that it had before it as far as the totality of the record.
See, that's the thing. How would you, I'm not playing gotcha with you, mm-hmm. but how would one tell that the board, on the one hand, weighed the evidence and said, and now, of course, the board didn't say it this way, but said, you know, hey, I'm confused about what the May 2009 examiner did because he seemed to say mild, then he said moderate. So I'm going to give that less weight and I'm going to put, you know, put it on the scale only halfway, right? That's the weighing of the evidence. But I'm not sure that we can say the board did that because it does almost seem as if it threw the exam totally out. I mean, can you point me to something that you think is the best example of where we can be confident that the board didn't simply totally discount the exam that it started out by saying was really good and just take it off the table?
It actually appears that if you look at page 19 of the record, which is 18 of the board decision, where it's discussing the examination in and of itself,
mm-hmm.
it does provide right there on its face the explanation as to why it found the opinion inconsistent. And then in the next paragraph, it does say that it acknowledges that report, but the entirety of the other late and other evidence during the period on appeal does not reflect a more severe impairment than contemplated on the level one rating. That appears to me that they had that one exam over here and all the rest of the evidence over here.
So
and they made a determination that it was not an equipoise.
So does it, is there anything to the fact that, and I can't really articulate this perfectly well, but that we, let's just assume then that we didn't throw out the May 2009 report. We just said it's not really good, great, you know, but there's some stuff in there that's okay. That report, even if it's internally inconsistent, might arguably be read to say it's not level three because it says some stuff about level two, right? But it doesn't say anything about level one. And it just seems odd that it's apparently a confusion between level two and level three, and then the ultimate conclusion is I'm going to go with level one. Do you see what I'm wrestling with there?
I do. However, I think what has been left out of the conversation, both with myself and opposing counsel, is that level one impairment for the first facet of 8045 is subjective complaints. Basically, it appears that what the board did, especially in light of the fact that it said that the examiner's opinion undermines the probative value of his determinations concerning the level of severity, it appears that what the board actually did was it did look at the part of the examination that contained appellant's subjective complaints, which it could do, and those complaints have actually been consistent throughout. Level one impairment.
Well, let me just stop there to make sure I'm following this, right? Because wouldn't that have been a foregone conclusion on this evidence unless the board determined that the veteran and the veteran's girlfriend, I think, who testified, were not credible? Right? Because, I mean, they both talked about subjective complaints, right?
But the time period is different. The board hearing wasn't until 2014. So the time period that we're talking about here is actually a little bit different. So it would be helpful and consistent with the record for them to actually consider his subjective complaints.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think my question was a bad question, so let me try it again. What I mean is, by the time the board gets the final package wrapped in a bow in 2016 and it's going to make a decision, right, it's got what I'm going to call snapshot evidence at different points in time. And it's not just snapshots because some of the snapshots look backwards and all of that. But it's got, at that point, the veteran's subjective complaints in the hearing testimony, which weren't just focused on 2014, of course. They went back, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, since the 10% rating is going to be tied to subjective complaints, unless the board found the veteran not credible, he's already got 10% at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm struggling with is then we have this 2009 report, which gets you above 10%, above subjective, by either level 2 or level 3. There's some, let's say the board is right, that the report is inconsistent. why would it be okay to not, even if the board said this is inconsistent, and so I'm going to, even though maybe there'd be other reasons to not do this, I'm going to go with the lower level, level two, right? But how can the board, without totally discounting that opinion, really still end up back where it would have started anyways, which is 10%?
Because, as I stated, they just discounted the portion on which the object, as it says here, that the part that it found inconsistent was the objective findings. That's the thing that helps him get to two or three.
Yeah, but...
He already, I mean, keep in mind, this isn't a service connection case, so he already had a 10% when all of this started anyway.
Absolutely. So what I'm struggling with on this point is, and I guess I'm going back again to this idea about what did the board really do with the 2009 report, because it seemed to say, well, the probative value is lessened because at some places it says two and at other places it says three, right? But if you were doing that, it's odd for me how the board gets to one without just saying, I'm just not going to count that exam at all. Because if you take the position that says we're going to be the least favorable to what this report says for the veteran, I understand the law is not that way, and you're not saying it, not putting it in the secretary's mouth. But let's just assume that's what the rule was, okay? So it's inconsistent between two and three. Wouldn't that leave you with two, even under a veteran-unfriendly rule?
The problem is, though, in order for the board to make that determination, it would have to actually interpret the examiner's findings. It can't base the idea of let me pick between two or three or nothing. And in this instance, unless there was some other evidence or record or a clarification, it really would be basing it on nothing, and we would still be here because I guarantee you, appellant would say the same thing he's saying right now. Well, how did you get two if over here it says it could possibly be three? I mean, it does not, I agree with you, it does not reconcile itself. But again, in order for someone to make that determination other than the examiner themselves, the court and the board would be stepping in the shoes of the examiner, and they cannot do that.
So what if I thought that really the big problem here, and this isn't the way that the appellant necessarily has framed it, but the big problem here is the board should have, you know, metaphorically picked up the phone and called the doctor and said, what did you mean? Right? In other words, sent it for a clarification. Let's just assume that that's what I think. It's what I think, I'll tell you. What do I do with that now? Right? You're right, it's 2017, it's not 2009 when this report happened.
Well, Your Honor, as I stated before, normally the remedy for a problem with the medical exam is either you can get clarification or you would have subsequent exams. Here there are subsequent exams, and the board looked at those things. The other issue is that...
Let me stop you there, though. Why does that necessarily solve it? Right? In other words, what if the board had sent the request for clarification to the doctor, and I'm blanking on the doctor's name right now, the examiner, and the examiner responded and said, no. He had mild memory problems, but when you put this whole package together on that first facet, it is moderate. I meant what I said. Let's just assume that was the clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't that have been really significant, even if you had later exams?
I'm actually not saying that it would not have been. I'm just saying that at this point in time, so much time has, because normally what happens is if an examination, and it's not in this particular instance, but in the instance where an examination is determined to be inadequate or defective for any other reasons, the cure is to either order an entirely new examination or to get a clarifying opinion. Here, because a clarifying opinion was not requested, and again, due to the time elapsed here, it's not really something that can be fixed. The next option would be the additional examinations. And again, because the court is confined to looking at whether or not the board had a plausible basis for what it did, the Secretary would submit that the board's actions here were plausible. Yes, maybe they could have been done better, but that's not what the clearly erroneous standard allows for the court to go back and fix. Additionally, just to address a couple of the questions that you asked appellate counsel, to respond to the suggestion that the Secretary did not respond to their argument as far as remand is concerned, while appellate may disagree with the way and the manner in which the Secretary's argument was laid out, as Your Honor stated earlier, this to some degree, because appellant is actually disputing the manner in which the board weighed the evidence, is a reasons and basis argument. The Secretary addressed it as such, and the same response throughout, in light of the fact that we're seeking affirmance, the same response, regardless of whether it's reversal that he's seeking or remand, is at the end of the day, it's a reasons and basis argument, and that was sufficiently addressed on brief.
Before you leave that point, what is the Secretary's position about what I'm going to call the limited nature of the remand? In other words, right, the appellant has requested that if the court finds error and if it isn't going to reverse, then we'll remand, but limited, the appellant asked, to the board making a determination about level 2 versus level 3. What's the Secretary's position about that?
Just before I answer that question, I see that I'm nearing the end of my time. Do you mind if I just have an extra couple of minutes at the conclusion of my response?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let me just clarify. You want to know whether or what our position is on the limited remand that they requested?
Yes.
Okay.
And again, this one isn't a trick question either. It's just, sometimes, most of the time, remands are not limited in that way. They can be. And so this is somewhat unusual. And I'll tell you, I'll tip my hand here. The way the appellant has, and you can address this on rebuttal if you want, Ms. Feller, the way the appellant has framed it, it actually sounds a little bit like a reversal through the back door, right? Because if I remand, but I say, you only have a binary choice, level 2 or level 3, right? You know, it's not quite a total reversal, but it's getting pretty close, right? So I just want to get the Secretary's position about what I should do.
Okay.
If I do that.
Okay. The Secretary's position on that issue is that we disagree with the fact that a remand would be limited to a 2 or a 3, because, again, that would rest on interpretation of the examination. Even if the court were to determine that the entire issue needed to be remanded for the court to make, for the board to make an actual finding as to pick one between, it's still the board still has to look at whatever determination it makes in light of all the evidence of record. And to tie their hands effectively by saying, hey, this is what I think you should do, pick this, is very much, as you stated, a backdoor means of reversal. So we do disagree with that. In the event that, the court is convinced that this case should go back to the board for consideration, then the appropriate way to do so would just be, if that's the issue, if, as you've indicated in some of your prior statements and questions, you're unclear as to how the evidence were weighed, so essentially you would be saying that you wanted a more clear reasons or bases, then the court should do that and allow the board to do its job. Because effectively, doing it the way that the appellant suggests would undermine the rest of the evidence here, because it also appears that, in his view, this one examination is the end-all, be-all to appellant's claim, which it is not. There is other evidence of record. There's consideration as to whether or not it's appropriate for a higher rating for a limited period of times, as you mentioned, stage ratings, whether or not it's appropriate for the duration of the time period. There's other factual questions that potentially, if this court were to either remand or reverse, that need to be decided on the first instance by the board.
All right. If there's anything else you want to say, because I took you over, feel free. Don't feel compelled, but feel free.
Again, the secretary does just want to remind the court that, again, it's whether or not the board acted in a manner that is based on a plausible basis, not whether or not the court agrees with how it did its job. In order for you to determine that the board's findings were clearly erroneous, that's the standard that you have to use. So based on that, the secretary's position is that the court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fowler, you have some rebuttal time, I think.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't expect to take 10 minutes. I wanted to start with what I think was one of the later points that you raised, and that is whether a limited remand would be an effective backdoor reversal. And I don't think that's the case. I think people could quibble over what you call it. I know that courts of appeals regularly limit remands. In my experience, which is mostly patent cases at the Federal Circuit, more than, I'd venture to guess, the majority of cases that are remanded with some sort of instruction or decision that by definition limits the scope of what will be decided on remand. And that can be done either by instructing the district court or the board in this case what should be considered, or it could be done by reversing certain findings. For example, you could, pursuant to your authority under 7261, set aside or reverse the finding that the May 2009 medical report is internally inconsistent. You could also reverse any, to the extent the board decided it, that the two subsequent medical reports, the January 2013 and the May 2015 reports, were probative as to anything before the dates on which those reports were provided. In other words, they don't say anything about Mr. Johnson's retrospective disability rating. All they can do in that respect is look to what his condition was at that point. And I wanted to touch on that for a second because it is important, I think, at the end of the day, to understand what evidence is in the record. And as the Mariano and Padgett cases say, ultimately your job in light of 7261 to review factual findings and determine whether they're clearly erroneous must take into account this, the benefit of the doubt rule. And the Padgett court specifically said you couldn't fulfill that obligation without commenting at least or mentioning the probativeness of the evidence. And so I think it's important to sort of lay out where we are here. You have the May 2009 medical report, which we've talked about all morning. That report says specifically up front that the board decision says that the report is competent, thorough, adequate bases to make a determination. It later says, as the secretary pointed out, that the other evidence appears to outweigh it, and that's at record 19. The board specifically says, with respect to the May 2009 report, while the board acknowledges this report, the entirety of the other lay medical evidence during the period on appeal does not reflect impairment more severe than that contemplated by a level one rating. So I don't think they threw it out. I think they did this sort of unusual thing where they said we're going to pick between one and three instead of picking between two and three. I don't think we need to send it back to the board to determine why they did that. I think you're authorized to determine it's clearly erroneous. So back to the other evidence that is in the record. You have the January 2013 medical report. And I want to point out real quick, the May 2009 report, Dr. Giovinco, expressly found based on his conduct of a formal mini mental status exam that he had moderate impairment. Okay. Jumping forward to the January 2013 report from Dr. Colson, he performed what was called a MoCA test, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. So that was objective testing. And as the secretary mentioned during her argument, or on behalf of the secretary, you have to have objective evidence to find anything more than level one. So what is in the May 2015 report? Despite being directed by the board to conduct a new examination, Dr. Colson relied on the objective testing that was done in January 2013. That obviously can't find anything more than level one because the doctor failed to conduct objective testing, despite the board's instructions to the contrary.
So I was intrigued by a couple of things. Is that the board? So for example, I had to learn about through the helpful work of one of my law clerks, this idea about subtracting serial sevens. As an aside, I got to tell you, I'm not sure I do very well on that test because I tried it the other day. But the board doesn't say anything about that in the report, and it struck me from what I had looked at that that could be something that would be quite significant.
I think it's important to recognize the only basis. I think this is important because in a beneficent system, I'm not sure it makes sense to the veteran or if it's fair to the veteran to send this back and let the board have another run at it. And so I want to be clear, the board found one basis and one basis only to decrease the probative weight of the report, and it was that it references to mild memory impairment were inconsistent with a finding of moderate impairment of memory, attention, concentration, and executive function. I submit that that is clearly erroneous, and frankly, it probably rises to the level of arbitrary and capricious such that you could reverse without any additional fact-finding. It's contrary to the face of the regulation as to what's rated. There is no category for memory impairment. It's subsumed within. And there is nothing in the board's decision that says that Dr. Giovinco's finding of level 2 or level 3 are unsupported. It just says it's inconsistent. I think it's not inconsistent. I think it's pretty clearly level 3 with attention, concentration, executive function predominating what he found to be mild memory impairment. There are adequate bases in the medical report to support that. An examiner need not comment on every favorable piece of evidence if the ultimate conclusion is sound, and no one has challenged the soundness of his conclusion. They're only challenging what is perceived as an inconsistency, and I think it's clearly not. And then you have the veteran and his girlfriend's testimony at the hearing, which the board found competent, probative. And I do think it's worth pointing out that the board itself found, based on the testimony, that review of the 2013 examination report and the veteran and his girlfriend's February 2014 hearing testimony reveals that the veteran's symptoms may have increased in severity. So the board recognized that. That's why they sent it back for an additional medical exam, which subsequently did not meet the mandates of what the board had requested. And I guess just going back to your binary analogy, unless you have any additional questions, I think the board's decision here is binary. I don't think that you have a choose your own adventure situation on your hands. The board, you know, chose between what it viewed as one and what the examiner found. Okay, and I don't think the examiner found two or three. The board interpreted it as finding two or three, but when you appreciate that there is nothing in Diagnostic Code 8045 about a memory impairment, it's the larger facet of memory, attention, concentration, and executive function. It's clear, and I think it's clearly erroneous to find otherwise, that Dr. Giovinco assessed Mr. Johnson at a level 3 disability rating. And we submit, based on the argument today in our papers, that you have the authority to reverse in this circumstance, given the mandate in 7261.
Thank you very much. If there's
no further questions, I'll take my seat.
Thanks. I appreciate it. And I want to thank both counsel. I understand that it might have been one of your first oral arguments. Is that correct, Ms. Jameson? You did a very nice job. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Mr. Fowler. And thank you for the briefing in this matter as well. That was very helpful to the court. So the court will be in recess, and I'll come down and say hello.
All rise. Where's the music?